Hello, today is Wednesday. This is Resonance Radio. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So this is Late Lunch with Out to Lunch. This week's broadcast will include part one of a fictional account of Out to Lunch writing an article for an academic music journal based in Francophone Quebec named Circuit or Circuit, a title derived from three compositions by Serge Garand, the French-Canadian composer who died in 1986. It'll also include some comments on the conference Capital, Empire and Revolution, staged last weekend at Birkbeck College by the journal Historical Materialism. And, as promised last week, some more trust to the idiolect, pestle and mortar prose by the tyro of Canadian Anglophone, Joycean word-bungling Ken Fox. My name's Ben Watson. Last week on Late Lunch, I invented a technique which is new to me, although extremely old hat to authors of novels of ideas such as Plato, Thomas Mann and Stuart Home, to name just three of the better ones. This is the technique of resituating theoretical or philosophical discourse in the mouths of fictional characters. Last week, I wanted to repeat a talk I delivered to the Actuel Marx conference in Paris the previous weekend, but found I needed to interpolate comments to explain the context to radio listeners. The person who originally wrote the talk therefore became a character called Out to Lunch, whose woeful ambition, tottering idealism, and towering absurdity could then be satirised and celebrated to the max. Contrary to Plato's own argument, which in the Republic, which is that artistic representations, being copies of everyday things which are themselves only imperfect copies of ideal prototypes, should be expunged from society. This technique actually makes ideas more vivid and more palpable. Bumped to earth by being placed in the minds and mouths of specific people, ideas lose their glossy quality as links in a chain of otherworldly transcendence, and instead become as social, motivated and bloody-minded as shouts on the street, gobs of spittle in the eye, or lime-green phosphorescent ectoplasm projectile vomited by a prepubescent film starlet. A technical problem I encountered last week is that it was difficult for listeners to distinguish between the reported speech of Out to Lunch, spluttering to his audience of three at the Actuel conference in Nanterre, and the narrator's urbane descriptions. The fact that Resonance FM has not yet reached the financial plane of being able to employ actors to read my scripts holds me back a little. So the assumption on the part of the listeners tends to be that everything is just my stuff, which of course it is. Except that all my stuff is actually a collage of Jeff Koons, the New Grove Dictionary of Music, Mike Barnes, Ken Fox and Stefan Mallarmé. This week I hope to clear up this confusion by colouring Out to Lunch's theoretical sections with Baroque music by Francesco Zappa, the Italian cellist who flourished as a composer between 1763 and 1788, as rendered digitally on synclavier by the Barking Pumpkin Digital Gratification Consort conducted by the 20th century Frank Zappa. Before we start, though, some real music. A few days ago, I was in the Amnesty Bookshop on Evershalt Street near Mornington Crescent, and I noticed some rather unusual LPs, a record of Chinese pipa music, which turned out to be horrible dinky subromantic drivel and not a bit like the wondrous music which Min Zhao Fen plays with Derek Bailey, and a record of two clarinet concertos by Karl Weber, the German romantic composer who flourished in the early 19th century. On this recording, made in 1968, the clarinet part was played by Benny Goodman, the heroic Jewish clarinetist who did so much to break down the colour bar in jazz, and also introduced a vein of cheesy blue humour into the art of band leading. As expected from a leading swing player, Goodman infuses the melodic line with his own personality. Last Friday at the Rada Bar on Mallet Street, I was invited to DJ for a party organised for the Historical Materialism Conference. Since this combination of Goodman and Weber, jazz man and classical composer, nicely broke the insoluble Kantian antinomies between world and idea, action and contemplation, appearance and essence, economics and culture, people and rulers, I thought it appropriate to begin my set with the last movement of the first concerto. Here's how it sounded. Imagine you're surrounded by people talking about the value form, the Treaty of Westphalia, the coming European Social Forum, and how many free beers you can drink before you fall over. We'll be right back. That was Amnerica from Civilization Phase 3, Frank Zappa's final masterpiece, a two-CD set issued in 1994, just after his death. Before that, you heard music by Karl Maria Friedrich Ernst von Weber, a German romantic composer with an extraordinarily long name, the third and last movement of his first clarinet concerto, written in 1811 for Heinrich Beermann, the virtuoso who brought this new instrument to maturity. There had been problems with keeping it in tune, a flexibility that led to its great popularity in jazz, where being out of tune is one of the improviser's great expressive resources. There it was played by Benny Goodman. Music works best when it causes controversy, dissension and debate. Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, late Coltrane, the Sex Pistols, early Eminem. A small example of this aspect occurred during my set for the historical materialism delegates. No one seemed to notice what I was playing when it was Weber and Zappa pastiching Tyrolean peasant tunes, or Archie Shepp and Miles Davis and John Lee Hooker playing the blues. However, when I put on a track of singer Phil Minton improvising with trombonist Günter Christmann, two individuals immediately detached themselves from the pressed ranks of people talking about the value form and drinking bottles of Carlsberg courtesy Merlin publishers. The first to reach me was a young guy called Ben, who wanted to know what the track was. He was most enthusiastic and he wanted a copy of it. The other was a slightly older guy called Gavin, who said it was jarring and could I please turn it down. See what you listeners think. I think the Minton Christmann track is best heard in the context it was programmed with last Friday night. To my ears, preceding it were the blues, Miles Davis on trumpet, John Lee Hooker on guitar, the great Earl Palmer on drums, a band put together by Jack Nietzsche for the soundtrack of The Hotspot, showed that actually, Minton and Christmann are playing inside one of the most accessible and intuitive musical forms ever invented, namely the blues.
Thank you.
That was Günter Christmann on cello. He usually plays trombone, playing cello there. And Phil Minton on belches, gurgles and wheezes, recorded live in Hanover in October 2001. Before that, the crunching rock instrumental was the end credits from Hotspot, the movie by Dennis Hopper, released in 1990. Now, I know you're all bursting with curiosity about the things Out to Lunch managed to find to say in a special issue of the Quebecois music journal Circuit, dedicated to Frank Zappa. There are other things worth reading in the journal, but they're in French, and judging by the vast amount of interest generated by my broadcast in September about Le Pingouin Ligoté, the organ of the Zappa fans based in Paris, Les Fils de l'Invention, the number of Resonance listeners who both like Zappa and read French, and have £5 to spare, is minimal. In this issue of Circuit, there's Nathalie Gatti using Gilles Deleuze to prove that Zappa can't be talked about in rational terms at all. Editor Réjean Bocage talking about Zappa's long-term interest in pure composition outside the rock market. Louise Morand's painstaking analysis of Dio Fa, or God is a Liar, as they say in Torino, Italy. The sombre and rather scary track from Civilization Phase 3. And John Rare doing pataphysical research into the meaning of the word Zappa, the phoneme Zappa, in Italian, English, French and German. This latter was the one that I really liked best. Zappa means hoe in Italian. Not the hip-hop for prostitute, but that modest garden implement, a metal blade at the end of a pole, which gardeners use to break up soil for planting tubers, seeds or cuttings. Apparently, when musicologist Nicholas Sleminski visited Zappa at his mansion on Woodrow Wilson Drive in Hollywood in 1981, Zappa told him that in Italian, Zappa means plough. John Rea calls this a typical example of artistic hyperbole. A plough is a far mightier groundbreaker than the humble hoe. The plough also figures cosmically as a name for the seven-star constellation, one edge of which points towards the North Star. Although the plough depicted in the sky, at least in medieval times, because the component stars of the constellation have drifted a bit since, is actually a single blade plough for use by one man, rather like a shovel or a spade, for use by one bloke rather than a team of oxen, a triangular piece of metal attached to a wooden pole with its point downward. So in comparison to the multi-bladed ploughs we see being pulled by tractors, the plough in the heavens is rather like a hoe. John Rare followed up all the various meanings of the phoneme Zappa. His materialist poetics discloses conscious and unconscious motifs in Zappa's oeuvre in a way denied to many of the contributors, who too often resort to the feeble device of quoting Zappa from interviews on websites to prove their points. On the phone to Leipzig yesterday, I complained to Jürgen Gispert, Zappology's only structural anthropologist, about this fixation on Zappa's own pronouncements, this inability to face the objectitude of the artistic commodity, and he laughed rather like Louis the Turkey. So imagine, if you will, Out to Lunch facing the screen of his antiquated word processor and attempting to summon the energies to write yet again about Zappa, someone he's been writing about for the last 30 years. Can he come up with some hot poop?
Wait a minute, we gotta get something happening. Yeah. He is in there spending thousands of dollars and shit. Should make this worthwhile. Should get into something real. He's not interested in the leather. Shit, that shit's been fucking rubbed in the ground, you know? Oh, Christ, that's going on 2 tours old now. We gotta come up with some new shit.
Then it struck Out to Lunch, something he'd heard from Zappa's own lips when he'd gone to Laurel Canyon to read him the manuscript of his 600-page thesis on his work. When Zappa referred to his recorded legacy, he didn't call it the project object or the output macrostructure as fans believed. These terms were in fact reserved for everything, including interviews with journalists and the secret raising of an eyebrow during a second take of the intro to Muffin Man. It took in God and the cosmos. Zappa called his recorded legacy his œuvre, but he pronounced the French word œuvre, or even hoover, a vacuum cleaner. Lunch recalled that when Bruno Latorhique originally constructed Wanda, the singing vacuum cleaner who appeared at every event organised by Les Fils de l'Invention, he placed a CD of choice morsels of salacious Zappobilia inside. Lunch knew that as he surrendered to the unconscionable provocation of Bruno's dried muffin remnants of audio, he would begin to hear the baroque sound of academic propriety and prestige in his inner ear, and he would be able to alchemize this sorry stuff into the gold of respectable musicology.
I see it, Barry. This should be a very dynamite show.
Frank Zappa's legacy, just another Hoover, an essay for Circuit, Montreal's most prestigious journal of musicology. Towards the end of his miserable existence on this benighted planet called the Earth, Frank Zappa referred to his back catalogue as the oeuvre. In keeping with his suspicion that art world jargon creates a snobbish divide between high-class consumers and the great unwashed, he took no effort to pronounce the French word correctly. Indeed, he seemed to relish his own mispronunciation on his lips. Oeuvre became ouvre, or even Hoover. So in Zappa's last days, his life's work assumed the name of the most famous brand of vacuum cleaner, as if it too were nothing but a commodity. Could this be the key to his legacy? That is what this essay proposes. Out to Lunch smiled to himself. This would give those francophone Canadians a run for their money. He caressed his own domestic Hoover, which he placed discreetly between his legs before sitting down to write, and pressed the on button. "Struth, this Hoover's really loud," Lunch said, and pulled the plug. The dying sound of the internal fan delighted him, spurring him to further zappological excess. Zappa instructed his family to sell off his back catalogue after his death. Having painstakingly reacquired his master tapes and re-edited and repackaged them as CDs, he wanted his family free of the responsibility of marketing them. In strict terms then, and despite the Zappa Family Trust's attempts to confer great composer status on him, Zappa's legacy is now just a set of commodities, a peculiarly cluttered and garish stretch under the WXYZ section in the pop-rock line at Tower Records, a Dada shrine at the end of a wailing wall of poop. Zappa's legacy gleams like one of Jeff Koons' Hoovers, an absurdity in the House of Culture. But before we explore this theme further, perhaps we could look at the way his legacy has been obsessed by more established means. To mark the 10th anniversary of Zappa's death in December 1993, Charles Charles-Murray, a fan of Zappa's group The Mothers of Invention in the 60s, presented three half-hour programmes about Zappa on Radio 3, the BBC's classical radio station. Titled Jazz from Hell, the broadcasts were in Radio 3's Jazz File slot directly after Jazz Record Requests, the long-standing Saturday tea time programme of nostalgic memories and home counties dedications. A tepid controversy broke in the quality press about Zappa's credentials as a jazz figure. His anti-jazz remarks were exhumed and tested for political correctness. Actually, Zappa's quips, "It's dead," its noodles, were mild indeed compared to the trashings of the term which have been voiced by Miles Davis, Ornette Coleman and Cecil Taylor in the past. When Zappa underwent a blindfold test in Melody Maker in 1968, he groaned at the lack of funk in the pop and soul releases, but responded with enthusiasm to the Elvin Jones trio. To tell the truth, the jazz angle was something of a change of heart for Murray, who'd panned Wacka Jawacka and New Musical Express on its release as a tedious jazz rock yawn. But it did allow Radio 3 to pretend that Zappa is now simply great music. Apart from some jazzoid instrumentals, i.e. a lot of Wacka Jawacka, and some guitar solos, most of what's actually on the records was avoided. Radio 3's listeners were therefore spared the inescapable offensiveness of Zappa's lyrics and musical shocks. Sound bites of alumni saying how great he was, that curious smarmy moment when praise sounds like a career move, made Zappa seem like something he never was, boring. Lunch was aware that he'd said something similar on air in Resonance FM back in February, but who was keeping count? Besides, this critique had surely not yet reached Francophone Canada. Zappa did not relish the prospect of entering history. In Them or Us, the book, which is written like a film treatment, one of Zappa's characters is Francesco Zappa, whose music is sounding in your ears as I speak. From his vantage point in the last half of the 18th century, Zappa's Italian composer cellist namesake asks, "Who'll be the Mozart of your miserable century? David Bowie? The people of your century no longer require the service of composers. A composer is as useful to a person in a jogging suit as a dinosaur turd in the middle of his runway. Your age is ugly and loveless, and when they eventually write you up in a leather book with a red silk thing hanging on the side, your nasty little Mozart will be a sort of egalitarian affirmative action non-person of indeterminate sex, chosen by a committee who will seek advice from a group of accountants, who will consult a tax lawyer, who will negotiate with a clothing manufacturer, who will sponsor a series which will feature a simulation of a lip-synced version of the troubled life of a white boy with special hair who achieves musical greatness through abnormally large sales figures. The reruns of this series will provide conclusive evidence to future music historians that the craft of composition did indeed reach the pinnacle of efficiency during the latter part of the 1980s. Mozart was a shithead. All the other big guys were twerps. For real achievement, nothing beats total obscurity." Lunch reflected that given the somewhat mechanical nature of Francesco Zappa's music, such historical obscurity was easy to understand, but that wasn't the point. The 18th century Zappa gave the 20th century one an excellent platform for a revolt against greatness, that so-called respect for art, which actually sucks away the oxygen of fun and creativity and makes everything and everyone so painfully boring. Lunch continued his critique of Charles Shaw Murray. Broadcasting "Mozart is a twerp" might have caused some ripples in the home counties and the upper echelons of the BBC. Indeed, Murray stuck exclusively to the safety of Zappa's instrumental music, completely unbalancing his artistic logic in the process, since words are fully part of his composition, like letters and words in a Dada collage. However, Murray did include a striking statement from Zappa concerning his own artistic legacy. In an interview with Nigel Lee for a BBC TV documentary in 1993, Zappa was asked how he thought he'd be regarded as a composer after his death.
"I don't think I'll be regarded at all. You know, if my name comes up, it comes up in a non-musical context. I'm the guy who went to the Senate to argue about dirty record lyrics, you know, or I'm connected with something else. But most of the people in this country have no idea what I do. I don't think that there'll be anything of what I do that will survive beyond my lifespan."
After this statement, Lunch felt the urge to expound an instant philosophy of living in the present, which is not mysticism but materialism, a polemic versus all those who allow the abstract of accumulation of value, capital, to prevail over musical and sexual pleasure in the present. Madonna and Sting and Bowie aren't about music, they're about the glamour of making money. Lunch believed that Zappa was a modern Diogenes, and as Peter Schlotterdijk has argued, Diogenes and his brand of bottom-barrel cynicism has a pressing relevance for our over-mediated times. However, Lunch knew that the editors of Circuit would think he'd rambled right off-piste, so instead clutching his ski sticks like badass pokers, Lunch turned his ire against those literal-minded fans who'd always given him and his interpretations such a hard time. With Zappa's death, the positivist or hardcore fans who abhorred speculation about Zappa's work, who only credited interpretations ratified by Zappa himself, are left high and dry. He's no longer there to interpret about the real meaning of his songs. If anything, his posthumous message was, "Don't regard me at all." Terrifying. We're out here on our own, without an instruction manual. However, if in keeping with the semantic playfulness which he exhibited at all times, the attention to the sound of words as much as to their official meanings, the notion of his oeuvre as Hoover does suggest a definite line of inquiry. Lunch was now in his element, justifying a ridiculous line of inquiry in the face of the opposition. This is what he'd done throughout his life, starting in 1968, when he'd written a parody of the Bible called The Holy Bobble, starring his schoolboy self as Jesus. The point was that Zappa was such a consistently objective documentarist of American life, of both its cultural trivia and its unconscious fixations and urges, that every motif in his work allowed for social analyses more profound than anything since Adorno and Horkheimer's Dialectic of Enlightenment. Lunch had written an account of dogs and poodles in Zappa's work in his 600-page book published in 1994. He'd done teeth at the Sorbonne in Paris in 1998. Esther Punk had done Burgers and Cars, Kaiser Rolls, at the International Conference of Ease and Plastic Zappology in January 2004. The madness could go on forever. He allowed Francesco Zappa's digitalized Baroque minuet to flood his brain and carried on with his exposition. Sold from door to door, the Hoover is the iconic 1950s consumer society commodity. The young Zappa attempted to shift Collier's encyclopedias. The young Captain Beefheart, then named Don Vliet, sold vacuum cleaners. One day, working his way round Antelope Valley, Vliet found Aldous Huxley answering the door. According to Mike Barnes in his biography, Captain Beefheart, Vliet attempted to sell him a machine with the immortal line, "Sir, this thing sucks." When Zappa presented his record-buying public with Captain Beefheart on the album Hot Rats in 1969, Beefheart was portrayed in colour negative, reds for greens, holding an old-fashioned, rocket-shaped, 50s-style vacuum cleaner. He offers it up to the viewer, his brow knitted like a priest distributing communion wafers. This photograph was selected from the shoot of Beefheart and the Magic Band by Ed Karieff for the Troutmouse Replica album. Other shots, as shown on the Revenant box set Grow Fins, had Bill Harkleroad, or Zoothorn Rollo, riding the vacuum cleaner and brandishing it as a phallus, and Beefheart luring it by its flex into his hat. The band were larking about, being, they hoped, salably bizarre, but in so doing invoked potent anxieties about mass-produced commodities and nature. On the back of Troutmouse Replica, Beefheart holds a glass table lamp against his chest, the electric flex dangling down past John French's ear. Outside the domestic sphere, plug-in apparatus is so much useless clutter. Like the mounds of dead consumer goods stumbled over by Joe after his escape from the closet on Joe's garage, and the mounds of dead appliances mentioned in Planet of My Dreams on Them or Us, Beefheart's vacuum cleaner casts a strange light on Zappa's technophilia, evidenced by the many images of Zappa at work on multi-track tape recorders and digital editors. One of these images directly faces Beefheart and his vacuum cleaner in the Hot Rats inner gatefold. The technocrat faces the unplugged back-to-nature weirdo. Zappa's dialectic between man and machine is perpetual and fulminating, unconstrained by the Cartesian dualism which has flawed French philosophy from Jean-Paul Sartre through to Gilles Deleuze. Lunch was unsure about this portion of his essay. Grand claims, even if aimed at francophone philosophical chauvinism, were weak. They didn't bite. They were a kind of lapse, a sentimentality. The rest of the issue of Circuit was full of them, mere assertions about Zappa's greatness and relevance, which wouldn't shift the opinions of the sceptical one bit. However, another option beckoned. This was not Zappology, but historical materialism. The idea that Zappa's Hoover sucks so convincingly, not because of the will or morals of the artist, but because it investigates the actuality of a larger beast, i.e. capitalism, or the world we're forced to live in. Lunch fell silent and allowed Ben Watson to pick up the thread. In a strand convened by Esther Leslie at the Capital Empire and Revolution Conference last weekend, Joseph Frakia from Eugene, Oregon, and Dave McNally from Toronto, Canada, proposed a new kind of embodied Marxism. Frakia and McNally explained Marx's Capital not via the equations and graphs beloved of professional economists, but as a criticism of the economic rationality that gives us economic crisis, world wars, and repetitive, boring, painful work. McNally alerted us to the jocular inversion of Marx in Capital, accusing capitalists of being hypnotized by the fetish of value and the commodity. Because it was the Spanish conquistadores, of course, who claimed that the natives they exploited and enslaved were less than human because they worshipped fetishes, idols made of stone and wood. Marx replied that the conquistadores made a fetish of gold. In Capital, Marx showed that capitalism is itself a religion, one whose pursuit of abstract value, capital, makes it inhuman and destructive, perhaps the worst religion mankind has found, even if it claims to be secular and rational. McNally's restatement of Marx's position is really useful. As the arms trade creates havoc in Africa and the Middle East, and global warming threatens the very existence of the planet, Marx's warnings have renewed relevance. Given a choice between the relentless pursuit of profit, which produces war, privatisation and unemployment, and Islam, which produces meetings where men take off their shoes and sing together on carpets, the religion of the oppressed doesn't seem like the ultimate evil. But it was Joseph Frakia's talk which shed most light on Zappa's oeuvre. He read us an extract from Franz Kafka's nightmarish story In the Penal Colony from 1919 and showed how Marx's Capital describes the same process, mechanical torture of the human body, where the sufferer is not told why it's happening. The coincidence between Marx's and Kafka's words, not anything conscious on Kafka's part, is quite uncanny. Now, in the sleeve notes to We're Only In It for the Money, the album issued in 1967 with a satire of Sgt. Pepper on the cover, Zappa tells his listeners to go dig up a book of short stories and read In the Penal Colony by Franz Kafka. As Louise Morin points out in her contribution on DFR in Circuit, the track The Chrome-Plated Megaphone of Destiny, On We're Only In It for the Money, from this track are referenced again in both The Torture Never Stops and in the central part of DOFAR. And indeed, these sounds from the chrome-plated megaphone of Destiny are a musical version of Kafka's torture machine, as the cogs and ratchets carve the name of the victim's crime in indecipherably complex twiddles and flourishes, rather like a banknote on the victim's back. As Adorno argued, modern music is like capitalism and the profit principle, a truth which hurts, whether or not you think you understand it. I had a pint with Frakia afterwards in the rising sun on Tottenham Court Road. Like many North American socialists, he seemed rather bemused that Frank Zappa could have any connection to Marxism. However, it's not just Kafka. Frakia is convinced that the other presiding literary subtext to Capital, this time explicitly, since it was available in Marx's lifetime and Marx makes references to it throughout the book, is Goethe's Faust. Now, it's a long detour, and if we got into it, we wouldn't be able to include any of Ken Fox's Earthworm Superconductor. But trust me, if you read Goethe's Faust and Thomas Mann's Dr. Faustus and then listen to The World's Greatest Sinner, one of Zappa's first forays into audio cartoon narrative, or He's Stealing the Towels from 200 Motels, or Titties and Beer from Zappa in New York, not to mention considering the figure of Uncle Meat in The Grand Wazoo, Ringo Starr as Zappa composing in 200 Motels, and the role of Hermann Kretschmar in Thingfish, you will find the resemblances to Faust quite spooky. Because Zappa claimed not to read any literature at all, apart from Kafka. These connections are so spooky, in fact, that they will drive you out to lunch. As McNally argued at the conference, capitalism is an idealist Christian invention. The use value of the commodity, its actual use for us, is its material body, while its exchange value, its use for generating capital, is its soul. And like Christianity, capitalism crushes the needs of the material body beneath the abstract soul. Goethe, Marx, Kafka and Zappa all unite in this analysis, whether or not they read each other. They didn't need to read each other. They read the Western problematic. Art is objective, not plausible. To draw on a comment made by Paul Matic at the conference, the bourgeoisie represents socially necessary labour time with prices and monetary figures, but like bourgeois oil paintings, realist novels and functional tonality, this representation has no indexical link to the truth. It requires crises and cruelty and suffering to keep it true to reality. Bourgeois economic representation is a front on monstrous exploitation. And in the futures markets of the 80s, as the future markets of the 80s became a grotesque fantasy, they had to come tumbling down in a financial crash. This appears to have become a North American edition of Late Lunch with Out to Lunch. If Marxists and Zappologists can survive there, they can survive anywhere, so take heart. Here's another Canadian, Ken Fox, who hails from Winnipeg in Manitoba, Canada. He has no claim on your attention except for the fact that his unstoppable verbal productivity is mining layers of material verbal clot unknown to the spirit-pure Simons of the academic postmodern ersatz. I'll carry on reading Earthworm's Superconductor from where I left off last week. I'd like to thank Tim Allen, the left writer and literary agitator from Plymouth, whose phone call helped me locate Fox's manuscript. I'd spent 4 hours looking for it in the maze of books our flat has become since Esther has invested in shelves from Habitat, IKEA and Argos. It was hiding on a shelf in my filing cabinet, marked Poets. And we've got 3 minutes in which I can give you some of Earthworm Superconductor. In the following pages, these two points of view will be soaked out and cut open across grain at a myriad of angles and allowed to intermingle. Neither will ever be convinced that the other's method has merit, so we're letting them duke it out on neutral ground to make it interesting and provide some motivation. We told them it's a battle to the death, and in a manner of speaking, it is. What we didn't tell is that the conditions of the mission require that neither survives. In order for data to be collected with sufficient objectivity, it is necessary that in the end their carcasses are equally dead, so that the minerals can be extracted without the interference of respiration, bloodstreams, brainwaves, etc. Naturally, the information we get will be the merged code of their characters, squishing out of the general collapse of their bodies. Against instructions, the success of the experiment will not be based on how comparable the two datasets are, but how inseparable they are. If two distinct character sets emerge, then we are ready to admit failure. If they emerge in a solid mass, then they will be ready for promotion from private and corporal to corporal and general. Selling swollen rocks. We looked and looked along the length of the arm and left off the end to take our daily bath in fingernail filings. The vanishing vistas spoiled our vantage. Plopped in the muddle of the rubbished road, they downloaded a large mountain into our thermos, allowing several splashes to land from the adjacent cup, with a wobble causing brownish spill since. They gathered all their rags to sop up the Martian mess, each depositing a chunk in their official pocket. My piece was a 30-micron slice with frapped glass and all the usual colours. It pulled me away, so I said, okay. If they wanted to put me in its mass spectrometer, and so I hesitated and then obeyed. Crudely, they dropped us from the snowbiling ice field into a plain, spotting dark rocks atop our lice-coloured peaks. The thinness of the vegetation sheets beneath confused me, so we broke off some pristine meteorites and stuck frozen to our plan. The weathering that occurred both aged us and preserved us. We strolled over the football field, keeping an eye out for stray tackles and ends. When I hollered, they all came over, jumping up and down on the warpage. And that's all we've got time for from Earthworm Superconductor. I think I'll try and fit some more in future programmes. The latest pamphlet from Ken Fox in Toronto. I promised last week I'd inform listeners about a new series of Ease in Plastic Tuesdays at the Royal College of Art. These are experimental drawing classes and are open to Resonance listeners. Just give me a phone call with your contact details, name and phone number or street address. No emails, please, here at Resonance. I'll give you the number in a moment, so find a pencil. At Ease in Plastic Tuesdays, we listen to the finest in poetry and free improvisation whilst drawing. We don't tolerate passive gawpers, but we deem anything you like to do drawing. Harry Gelonis writes words down, for example. I pretend to be making subjective mini-disc recordings, but I'm actually dancing. Nelly Condottieri draws wild cartoons. Gamma makes pictures of poodles in scrub charcoal, or simply grunts approvingly, pencil in hand, and contemplating his easel like a reincarnation of Augustus John. Matthew Hughes stares intensely into the flea pit of his cadaverous desires. Mindy Lee blindfolds herself and flicks paint all over her paper. Esther uses her camcorder. The next four Ease in Plastic Tuesdays start next Tuesday, 20th of October, with Bark, the trio led by drummer Philip Marks from Manchester, with Paul Obermeyer on sampler and Rex Caswell on guitar. Then on 26th of October, it's a solo set by saxophonist Rob Mills from Echo City, the environmental improvising troupe. On 2nd of November, it's Len Mass's Auto Digest with Alan Wilkinson on saxophones. And on 9th of November, it's Stuart Home, a lecturer on the project for an imaginary Bauhaus and Giuseppe Pinto Galizio's industrial painting, a reply to remarks made by Francis Stracey and myself at the Actuel Marx Conference in Paris at the beginning of October. To attend any or all of these drawing classes, or to obtain details about Circuit, which contained the essay on Zappa I fictionalised as a text by Out to Lunch, please leave your contact details at Resonance. And the phone number is 0207 836 3664. That's 0207 836 3664. And I'll get in touch with you. To become part of the Ease in Plasm is a big step, and not one to be taken lightly. But if you're interested in subverting the hold which the commodity form has on significant artistic endeavour, please do phone. You've been listening to Late Lunch with Out to Lunch, which appears on Resonance 104.4 FM every Wednesday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Please tune in next week, where you'll hear some of Bark's set at the RCA, and maybe an in-person interview with Rex Caswell about his music, about Copenhagen, where he lives now, and about his involvement in the late 80s Hume scene in Manchester, playing guitar in groups like Those Who Celebrate and Stockhausen and Wartman. Many thanks to Ken Fox for continuing to supply me with his amazing prose. By the way, I trust in Ken's methodology so much that I never pre-read what he's written before reading it on air. I hope it didn't sound too bad. It's as new and amazing to me as it is to you. This is Ben Watson, drawing mysterious totalising gestures in the air and realising he's actually still got a minute, so let's see what's on the mini disc. Was that Edgar Varese or Johnny Guitar Watson? I can't tell. So this is Ben Watson saying goodbye because it's 3 o'clock and epistaxis time, which I've failed to queue up, but I should get it in just at 3 o'clock. Here we go. Here's Dan Wilson. Goodbye. Louise Morin's painstaking analysis of Dio Far, or God is a Liar, as they say in Torino in Italy, and Louise in Italian.
On the fourth anniversary of the Palestinian Intifada, Israeli military forces have invaded Jabalia.